minute, let me borrow your ear, and I'll sing you a song about Leonard Peltier. He's gone so long in a federal jail, and there ain't no way that you could pay his bail. In South Dakota, where the fear has grown, where the president's a watch from a mountain of stone, they say all people are free to roam. There ain't no freedom in the Indian home.
Dealing with a third, a fourth victim in which the government had to have a scapegoat because of the diversionary tactic that they created to discredit our people through the media to get away with the acts of what they're now doing today, and that's exploiting the resources from our land.
And that was when the agents had made their play in a gunshot battle on a deadly day, and three men died in the hollow sand, two FBI and an Indian man.
I think many people always ask, well, why did the shootout happen? What was going on? But people just don't know that during that very same time period, Richard Wilson, who was then the acting tribal chairman, was in Washington, D.C., signing away 1/8 of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, the Black Hills of South Dakota, which is 133,000 acres of land and valued at billions of dollars of uranium deposits that are being strip mined out of there by over 40 corporations today.
The charge was set for homicide, but Leonard got away to the Canada side, where he lived for a while in the northern town, till they came up and got him and brought him back down.
And today we have a liberation of Lakota people who have occupied 800 acres of land, which is now called the Yellow Thunder Community, which is one of the richest areas in which the deposits are laying. And so the government is very uptight about this at this time.
The judge and the jury, they both agreed. 2 times murder in the first degree. They pounded the gavel and they rang on a bell. 2 times life in a federal cell. Citations came from Washington. Congratulations on a job well done. 2 agents gone is a mighty price, but if you want something bad, you gotta sacrifice.
Now, there's many books on domestic surveillance, on counterintelligence programs. I mean, the Fred Hampton case, those were real cases where police agencies violated civil and human rights, and even according to their own ethics, violated law enforcement codes of ethics. People need to understand that that's true, those are facts, and if they ever allow us, for example, in the case of Leonard Peltier, very soon, we hope to prove that.
And now Leonard Peltier is a captured man with both legs taken so he cannot stand. One more swallowed by the master plan to get their hands on the Indian land.
We spotlight Leonard Peltier, a man who is recognized internationally as a political prisoner being held in jail in the United States. His story tonight on Alternative Views. Good evening. Tonight on Alternative Views, we're going to have an in-depth look at kind of two aspects of one subject, the Native American and how the Native American is treated in the United States. It has to do with civil rights. What happens when the U.S. power structure decides that, hey, we don't like these people? It results in political prisoners. Also, the program tonight will give us an insight into the thinking and culture of the Native American and how in touch with the universe and nature these people still are. We'll see that later in an interview with the cousin of Leonard Peltier, the political prisoner who is in jail. But first, we'll have some news.
I saw an article in the Christian Science Monitor about midway through August about Union Carbide, and they've been having quite a bit of trouble. You may remember the incident in Bhopal, India, where 2,000 people were killed and another 200,000 were injured. Well, shortly thereafter, they had a leak at a plant in Institute, West Virginia, and more than 130 people were treated for problems with their eyes, lungs, nose, and throat, and another 30 were hospitalized overnight. Now, the interesting thing about this is despite Union Carbide going out and investing $5 million in safety devices for the Institute plant, they apparently didn't work as well as they thought they were. Salient points in this article, they mentioned that if this case is tried in a U.S. court, it could very much undercut Union Carbide's claim that the Bhopal accident occurred because of procedural errors on the part of the Indian workers. In other words, the Institute accident could be used as evidence of a pattern of sloppy safeguards by Union Carbide themselves. Now, I also, last March, I think it was, I cut an article out of the Wall Street Journal. I'm an inveterate newspaper cutter, and I hung on to it because I thought it might prove interesting eventually, and I think it proved me right here. The article is a front-page story dealing with insurers. It seems that they're shunning covering chemical and other pollution-causing industries. This dates back to 1982 when the EPA ordered hazardous waste facilities to get liability insurance against chemical accidents in the wake of numerous revelations. One, for instance, I reported on a couple years back, one enterprising young truck driver, he had a tank full of toxic waste to dispose of, and he wasn't sure what to do with it, so all he did was opened up the spigots on the back of his truck and drove up and down the highway until it was all gone. Well, so they came out and said that they had to have insurance. Well, the problem is that in the last few months, remember this is in March, the pollution liability insurance field has virtually collapsed, the Wall Street Journal reported. They said that rates have climbed 50%, 200%, and even higher. And on top of that, coverage has been curtailed sharply, with maximums reduced to $10 million or less. And all but three or four of the 14 companies and pools that issued this kind of insurance have pulled out, including the number one company, that's Shan Morahan and Company of Illinois, who last year insured 30 to 40% of the market. One of the insurance men was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying, "Pollution claims hold out the prospect of widespread insolvencies among the major carriers of insurance for these companies. Environmental regulators keep trying to make insurers the cowcatcher on the regulatory locomotive." So what this boils down to is that the law still requires these companies to buy insurance, but now there aren't very many insurance companies that are really willing to bet that they're not going to have accidents. Frank, you got something over there for us?
Well, I hope so. Here are just a few little quotes from Reagan. Some of you may have heard before. It came out on a little advertisement blurb for the magazine The Nation. Here's one I haven't heard. Reagan on the environment said, "There is today in the United States much more forest." No, he said, "There is in the United States today as much forest as there was when Washington was a valley forest."
That's a miracle.
And now we turn to the centerpiece of tonight's Alternative Views, the American political prisoner, Leonard Peltier.
Remember many months ago when Andrew Young said, "Hey, we got some political prisoners in the United States." Everybody said, "Oh, not in the United States of America, the Stars and Stripes and all this." What an uproar. But that's about as far as it went. Nobody said, "Hey, Andrew, who are they? And how did they happen to get there? Why are they political prisoners?" We've talked quite a bit on Alternative Views about this subject. And tonight we're going to focus on one bona fide political prisoner in the United States, Leonard Peltier. You ever heard of him? Leonard Peltier. Perhaps not. The mass media haven't done too much on him, if anything. Well, we have two people who are going to fill you in on Leonard Peltier, what happened to him, how he was railroaded into prison, how the FBI was involved with tampering of witnesses, harassment, scaring of witnesses, doctoring of evidence, withholding of evidence. Right up and down the line, right through the trial judge. Can this happen in the United States? Well, it already has. And who else more than Leonard Peltier? Well, we don't know yet. But we're going to look at Leonard Peltier tonight very, very closely. We have Raul Salinas, who is the representative from the Southwest region of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. And we're very privileged to have a cousin of Leonard Peltier, Steve Robidoux. Can you tell us first, for the people who don't know, the history of the Peltier case?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, Leonard Peltier, first of all, is a Lakota. He is a member of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, in which he is from the section of North Dakota. And presently, Leonard is in prison doing two consecutive life sentences for original charges, which were aiding and abetting in the deaths of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, which took place on June 26, 1975. Now, on June 26, 1975, there was a shootout that had taken place in which two FBI agents illegally entered the reservations to serve fabricated arrest warrants, which they were never able to produce in the trials, okay? Now, immediately upon the agents entering the reservation, they came in, two agents, one in each unmarked car, radios and heavy equipment, and immediately a firefight had broken out. As a result of a firefight that had lasted for approximately 8.5 to 10 hours, there was two FBI agents and one Indian man by the name of Joseph Stuntz, who to this day we have never had an investigation into the circumstances of his death. Immediately, the FBI put out to the media that militant Indians, hostiles, terrorists who were trying to take over the reservations had killed two FBI agents, and there was a manhunt out for these so-called Indians. Eventually, four men were arrested and charged with aiding and abetting in the deaths of two FBI agents: Leonard Peltier, Dino Butler, Bob Robidoux, and a young man by the name of Jimmy Eagle, who later the charges were dropped because he was the person in which the government had claimed their reason for going in with the arrest warrants, which was for assault and robbery, was their excuse. Charges were dropped on him. Now, Leonard was underground for some time, facing already convictions through the media, being put on the 10 most wanted list even before he had went to trial, labeling him as a cop killer, as a slayer. When he was captured in Canada, Dino Butler and Bob Robidoux were captured in the United States, and they went on trial in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1976, while Leonard went on trial in Canada, fighting political asylum in Canada, fearing that if he was returned back to the United States, he would not receive a fair trial or possibly be killed, and also in recognition as being a member of the American Indian Movement.
He was one of the leaders of the American Indian Movement,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, he was recognized throughout many communities as an organizer for the people. Yes, he had a very responsible job and was recognized to that effect.
Steve, what were some of the things he did in the American Indian Movement? What were some of his political activities that made him a target for the FBI?
Well, I think one of the most important things to really clarify in a brief way is that through the years, people have labeled the American Indian Movement as militant and radicals to the media that was presented by the government agencies to the media. We, in turn, have had to survive this attack on our people because the whole philosophy of the American Indian Movement was to stand for the honoring of over 372 treaties signed with different nations in the United States and Canada, and which today have never been honored. Not only the honoring of the treaties, but the traditional forms of government of many nations, the philosophies of their culture and their spiritual ways within their own land base, which is very serious because we see through the system today that the education system of America has did nothing but not only destroy native people's language and took in their land base, but it's attacking people around the world, such as we've heard tonight about El Salvador. The people are struggling for their land and their rights, their rights to survival, and this is what the American Indian is all about today. I don't like to use the term American Indian, but people are educated to identify us like that, so we'll respect it that way to a degree. But regardless, These here were Leonard's duties, to learn those traditions and those philosophies. But at the same time, we had to deal with society in which our people have been forced to live, on how we survive in this education system today, in the society, on how we have to provide for our families. We have to learn an education to do this. And so in order for us to have equal rights, which were being denied minority people throughout every urban community in the country, welfare programs, education programs, halfway houses for offenders, orphanages for the children. Even our old folks were sent to foster homes because we didn't have nobody to take care of them. We couldn't even take care of ourselves, let alone worry about the respect that we used to maintain for our elders and our children. See, so these are philosophies and these are experiences that Leonard had was going through at the time of all this bad media that was facing our people struggling for these real changes. He was a hunter and he was a provider. He was a provider for the people.
One of the more concrete tasks that Leonard carried out, again, what Steve is referring to is the relocation of people from the reservations into the urban areas, especially during the 50s, late 40s and 50s, where Native people came to urban areas. And the shock of being away from the reservation, and then the lack of employment, the lack of skills, the alcoholism which runs rampant in Indian country, and when we say Indian country, we mean through the Americas. And so Leonard was, for example, in Milwaukee, an alcoholic counselor. He had a people's workshop of auto mechanics to work on people's cars that were on the trails and traveling across the land. To support Indian people's causes. And so, aside from that, his spiritual duties, which encompassed being a pipe carrier and a sun dancer, enabled him to talk to some of our youth and always took young people with him on the trail, as we say, when he had to go do a job like speak or gather people for a fishing, honoring fishing ceremony or those things. As part of what Leonard's work entailed.
Getting back to the case then, the other people involved or charged were also acquitted.
All right. See, we were right at that part to where Leonard was fighting extradition in Canada. Now, Dino and Bobby were going on trial in Cedar Rapids, Iowa at that time, and they were acquitted on grounds of self-defense and misconduct of the FBI. Okay, it was proven even by Clarence Kelly's testimonies throughout that trial that they did have a counterintelligence program designed on the American Indian Movement, and they did believe that they were honest people struggling for social change and rights for the people. You know, I mean, we had all these positive energies come out, but see, we're dealing with a third, a fourth victim in which the government had to have a scapegoat because of the diversionary tactic that they created to discredit our people through the media to get away with the acts of what they're now doing today, and that's exploiting the resources from our land. Mm-hmm. And because during that same time of the shootout, I think many people always ask, well, why did the shootout happen? What was going on? But people just don't know that during that very same time period, Richard Wilson, who was then the acting tribal chairman, was in Washington, D.C., signing away 1/8 of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, the Black Hills of South Dakota, which is 133,000 acres of land and valued at billions of dollars of uranium deposits that are being strip mined out of there by over 40 corporations today. And today we have a liberation of Lakota people who have occupied 800 acres of land, which is now called the Yellow Thunder Community, which is one of the richest areas in which the deposits are laying. Mm-hmm. And so the government is very uptight about this at this time because throughout their year's existence there, on April 4th, they have gained the support of not only international support, but over 40 congressmen who are now trying to pass a bill to the National Park Services to clear the land for the Indians' use. Because everybody knows that there's a big controversy about who really owns the hills. Does the United States government or does the Indian people? And how long can we be blind to go along with a government who has all the control of all the policies, law enforcement, the laws and everything to back them up? And how can these obstacles deny what is really true? Because the land does belong to the Native people. They are the caretakers of the land. And today we talked about treaties, on how the treaties were designed to, as long as the grass shall grow and the rivers flow and there was night and day, that we would be able to use the land freely for our future generations.
And that treaty was I forget, what was the date?
1868.
It was a few years before that, because 1868 was a new treaty at the time. It was the last treaty. Mm-hmm. But regardless, see, and then the American people and people internationally feel that the United States is honoring Indian people. And this isn't the case, because they use us through what they call the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in which many of our traditional people do not believe. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is just a branch of the United States government that is funded through every other kind of little project on how they want to keep the assimilation and genocide going to destroy our language and our land. And that's what it's really all about, and they did a very good job of it. Because right now, living on the reservation, people think that we have it made. We're getting land lease agreements and money's coming all the time. And the Indians can just kick back and take it easy. But this isn't so, mm-hmm. because you go onto the reservation and you got the highest poverty in the country going on besides the ghettos and the communities. I mean, you know, it's the highest. You have, for gasoline, it's almost up to $2. For bread, it's over $1.50 in some of the stores. And yet all your stores and your ranches and all the people who are leasing the land from the Indians are white ranchers who have control of the politics that go on in the communities, with your mayors and your different politicians that make up a city council. You know, I mean, we have to deal with all these kind of confusions that completely take away from our lifestyles, our language. Just as sure as I'm sitting here talking English to you, I've been robbed my language. And this is a hurt feeling of, you know, it's a survival feeling, you know. And today, our people on our last stand to re-educate ourselves and to reclaim the land in the best way possible against all these laws and regulations and policies that have been put onto our people. It isn't a very job that we have to be forced to become citizens when we're already a nation of own in our own land. But yet we're not allowed to practice the freedom of religion, and they talk about the First Amendment of the United States, that it has to be honored among all people, but we see every day that it's being denied us every day. And it's not only Native people, because once you've taken a people and their land base and their language, then you've conquered a people. But you can never you will never capture the true spirit of people's resistance to face the oppression that is being forced on them right now. Because just like the people in El Salvador, it's a natural reaction that you must stand in defense of your land when you're oppressed by an oppressor. It's your natural duty to stand up and defend yourself and to protect your land and to protect your women and children, such as Leonard Peltier was doing on June 26th, when men, women, and children and old people were running for their lives.
As I understand it then, there was practically a reign of terror.
It was a reign of terror.
Among the goon squads that the on the... With the people, Richard Wilson's people, in support of the Bureau of Indian Affairs itself.
And it still exists today.
Still?
It still exists today, because they're getting ready for some other moves or some kind of infiltration to discredit the people, to make their move for the next big grab, is what it amounts to. And how they use people, we're yet to find out, such as we did with Leonard and all the people related to his case. I mean, in a six-year process since Leonard's been incarcerated, I mean, it's going to be 7 years since the shootout in June. This coming June, I mean, we have a total of 12 people who have been killed. We've had tens and hundreds of people who have been harassed and intimidated. And today it's continuing on, with one key witness, such as the name of Myrtle Poorbear, who was an Indian woman out of the community of Allen on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, who the FBI had used to illegally extradite Leonard from Canada under false affidavits that they forced her to sign under a protective custody plan. And the tactic there was that members of the American Indian Movement and members of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee were going to go out and kidnap her, such as we were going to take the judge, we were going to get different government officials in exchange for Peltier. And people have to remember that we're peaceful people. You know, we understand the laws and the pressures in which we're faced, that if we violate the law, we're going to be abused through the court system and through the federal prison systems. This is automatic for our people, because we've got heads banging against those cell bars every day that we're trying to free, such as Richard Marshall, who is another person in which the government used the same woman, Myrtle Poorbear, to illegally convict Marshall because he was linked up with Russell Means activism in relation to liberating the independent nation of Wounded Knee. Yes.
Whereas the other two American Indian Movement leaders who were let off on the trial were able to use evidence of FBI misconduct in the whole trial, Leonard was not able to do this.
No, he was not able to
do this. How come Leonard wasn't able to have the charges dismissed on the grounds of this FBI misconduct? And what was some of the FBI misconduct and some of the strange circumstances surrounding his case.
I think we can get into a lot of time there, you know. But Leonard, he was a scapegoat. He had to be the scapegoat to make an example before the people that nobody gets away with killing law enforcement agency, no matter what they do in terms of police brutality in the communities and on the reservations and around the world as far as that goes. But Leonard was not given due process of law, none whatsoever, because Judge Benson of the trial, the Federal District Court out of Fargo, North Dakota, was very open and very biased to every motion of proof that was made for dismissal or a new trial, okay? He even went through such extremes that to state, even though we had proof to show that the FBI was lying, he would say the FBI is not on trial here, Leonard Peltier is. Okay, we have to go through instances to show the state of mind on how they psyched out the jury, okay, such as with bloody autopsy pictures that were taken of the dead agents. Now, it was after the second autopsy, because it was through the second autopsy that we not only find the bloody picture mess scene in which they wavered before the jury's faces, but we come to find out that each of the agents just had a bullet in them, but yet the media put out information saying that the agents were slain and riddled with bullets. And things of this nature. And so they would wave this around. And today we have documents from the Freedom of Information Act files on the FBI files that were released to us through that act. We have documents showing that the AR-15 and that they used in Dino and Bobby's trial as well as Leonard's trial.
That's the rifle, right?
That's the machine gun. This is the one that's supposed to have riddled the bullets with agents. Mm-hmm. We have a document today showing that it wasn't even the gun. It was just an excuse gun to put in its place, okay? Let alone a .223 shell casing in which there were thousands of them. It wasn't even the shell casing that went into the gun they used as a phony.
That was the fabrication of evidence.
That was the fabrication of materials and evidence, exhibits as they call them in the trial proceedings.
And they also withheld evidence, which would have cleared.
Oh, yes, by all means.
Completely.
Well, it was all, regardless of the information, actually, it was all proven through the original trial. But there was no due process. There was prejudice, racism. And they had to have a conviction, and they did it very openly. Even after the trial was over, Prosecutor Haltman would come out to the media and say that the American court system did its duty to protect the violators who offend the law. You know, I mean, it was really gross to take, but, I mean, regardless, we've taken Leonard's case all the way to the Supreme Court to where our last chance today is what they call the writ of habeas corpus. And the writ of habeas corpus is what they call in legal terms a 2255 that has to introduce positive new evidence. So through the Freedom of Information Act files, we have that positive new evidence that only strengthens the old evidence, as well as exposing over 12,000 pages of FBI documentation, and, 15. And then there's 12,000 pages that are still being withheld, which is very important. But at the present time, our attorneys have the writ into the typist, and it's ready to be filed very soon. Mm-hmm. And so, but see, getting back to the writ of habeas corpus, which I really feel is important, is that it's Leonard's last leg for freedom, you know, to receive a new trial so he can gain his freedom. Because if we can't build awareness for people to become involved with constitutional rights in which we're all bound to, those constitutional rights today are being threatened to be chopped up, such as the habeas corpus right. Last year, they had over 8,000 cases of writ of habeas corpus, and almost every one of them were rejected or denied. If any of them did make it, then it had a little publicity behind it in order to give that picture to the people of the American minds that they were doing their duty. But now they're trying to pass a law to do away with that right. Once you get to the Supreme Court, you ain't going to have any last legal remedies to gain your freedom, you know. And so we're dealing with a lot of innocent people who've already been through these experiences and just gave up the spirit to just do their time.
It was claimed by the prosecution that the bullet that killed the FBI agents came from Leonard Peltier's gun, whereas the actual analysis by the FBI laboratory itself indicated that the bullets that killed the FBI agents did not match the gun.
Well, see, it was obvious.
This is a significant piece of new evidence that is a scandal that he was convicted on the basis of this false evidence, and that the FBI withheld the evidence. And there was a second point, too, that it was claimed that an FBI agent saw Leonard Peltier shooting through a scope of his rifle, and it turned out that none of the rifles had a scope.
Right, exactly. I was going to get into that a little bit. But
plus the fact that even it was at night anyway.
It happened in the early morning hours, and it lasted way until into the to 6 o'clock in the afternoon to where they just had, within minutes, within 20 minutes to a half hour, these guys are on the radio. Even the transmission radio calls and the reports were all fabricated, okay? The whole story. Okay, now, within a half hour, here's the National Guard, the 82nd Airborne, Armed Personnel Carrier, State Police, City, County and City Police, BIA Police, automatically on the scene. And, you know, they had the few days from our investigations of the people, several weeks before, they had BIA Police coming in and were staking out FBI agents to know the area. Okay, now they already had plans for what was to happen on June 26, 1975. And yet they talk about these bullets that were related to Leonard and his gun. I mean, we have to go back into simple realities of the firefight. There was a firefight had taken place. Who killed Joe Stuntz? You know, who really killed those agents has never been established. Leonard was originally charged with aiding and abetting along with all the defendants. But yet when he was convicted in Fargo, they just happened to put murder. He was convicted of two counts of second-degree murder.
There's been a lot of international support and interest in this case, hasn't
there? Oh, yes. In 1978, when Leonard's case was in the Supreme Court, was our first trip to Europe. Myself and Luke Gerwitz, who was one of Leonard's attorneys at the time, our whole purpose was to go to Amnesty International in London to see if we couldn't get them to adopt Leonard as a political prisoner of conscience. We were very lucky to go there because they had Leonard's case buried under the table, because throughout all the processes of his trials, appeals, everything, all they were was observers, okay? Because when you're dealing with Native nations, Native nations is the only race of man that has never been supported by Amnesty. Okay, because of technicalities that I'd like to get into a little later briefly. But we went to London, and we were able to explain their reasons why they denied Leonard's case, okay, why they were quiet with it. And it was because of the violence. So when we explained the self-defense and the attack on the people, they had different point of views to where they gave us a 5-point letter of the main points on why the Supreme Court judges should allow Leonard a new trial. Okay, but regardless, we were still denied to the Supreme Court. But throughout that process now, Amnesty also come up with other excuses that they couldn't do it because of technicalities after we cleared the violence concept, okay? So the whole analysis of, to put it really briefly, is why they can't support Leonard's case technically, is because you're dealing with a nation of people who are not recognized as a nation of people by an oppressed government, the United States government, under treaty law. And today that comes to be fact, because we look at El Salvador, we look at Puerto Rico, who is struggling for nationhood, and we see how they miscredited the freedom nationalists of Puerto Rico by putting them as terrorists and militants. You know, I mean, it's people's ways they speak out, and for sure it's wrong. But how else do you get the attention of all the people who are out just worrying about their lifestyles and don't have time to become involved with serious things?
Raul, you've been to Geneva and the UN about this case. Can you tell us about your experiences there?
Yes, well, after the trip to London to Amnesty International by Steve and one of our attorneys, Lou Gerwitz, there was a gathering at the 4th International Bertrand Russell Tribunal, at which Steve again addressed the body there. Later, I was asked by the defense committee to represent our group, represent Leonard in Geneva. I traveled with the International Indian Treaty Council as a delegate of the Treaty Council, but as a representative of Leonard Peltier and the committee. I was able to address the entire body on two occasions. The International Treaty Council has non-governmental organization status, which is a non-voting, but yet there is a voice, and so I was one of the delegates to speak of the delegation. I addressed the entire body regarding Leonard Peltier, and I was also able to come in because of my presentation regarding Leonard and other Native political prisoners, Dickie Marshall, Rita Silk Nonai, David Ruiz, it created, along with the question of the indigenous people in Nicaragua, it created such an interest at the United Nations commissions that we were given a special session for political prisoners. At that point, I elaborated and made some concrete requests of the international bodies that they take on some plans of action regarding Leonard Peltier. We were, believed, very successful in that the president of the body there, Roma Chandra, from India, ended the conference by alluding to the symbol that Leonard had become to the people by the witnessing of how the many representatives of Native nations conducted themselves there in Geneva, and he ended the entire session with a poem that Leonard wrote in a British Columbia prison entitled I Am the Indian Voice. As a result of that successful meeting, as a result of us very clearly standing alongside the Sandinista government in their explanations of the question of indigenous people, which U.S. propaganda machines have tried to portray in other ways to us here, the International Indian Treaty Council was invited to Nicaragua in December, where the Third Assembly on Racial Discrimination, Recourses and Procedures on Racial Discrimination was held. And again, I was asked as a representative of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee to serve as interpreter and translator for the International Treaty Council. I was not able to present to the entire body, but since we were guests of the Nicaraguan government and we had been very personal friends of Comandante Lumberto Campbell, I was able to do a very detailed and in-depth interview presentation on Sandino TV regarding the case of Leonard Peltier and David Ruiz and Rainey Street here in Austin. So it was very successful, and we have people that we have now. We don't have a committee there in Nicaragua, but we certainly have an information center where we send all our materials, and they're disseminating it, and a lot of Nicaraguan children are wearing Free Peltier T-shirts, and so it was very beautiful.
Well, this Peltier case is part of a mainstream of violation of civil rights and genocide against Native Americans for years and years, but it's also part of a continuation of COINTELPRO program by the FBI, which has been going on for many, many decades against people of all races and colors and ways of thinking.
Right. That's exactly what we're about, talking to people wherever we go, all over this country and all over this world. We're trying to say to people, hey, you don't know that there was an Operation Bisent in 1976 when we were going across the country to Washington, D.C. to articulate our grievances to the U.S. government, directed primarily at the American Indian Movement and other terrorist groups, as they called it. We also need to have people understand that the U.S. government and its law enforcement agencies against Native people had something called Operation Garden Plot and Operation Cable Splicer. People need to understand that these are not figments of radicals' imaginations.
What were these two operations?
These were surveillance gathering and counterintelligence programs, internal, domestic, what do they call it, domestic surveillance programs, aimed primarily at Indian people, specifically after the Wounded Knee Siege of 1973. From that point on, I believe 74 and 75 was Operation Garden Plot and Operation Cable Splicer. It's documented if people read, and especially on college campuses where we think people read, but somehow they don't read what's out there in the world. People need to read. There's many books on domestic surveillance, on counterintelligence programs. I mean, the Fred Hampton case, those were real cases where police agencies violated civil and human rights, and even according to their own ethics, violated law enforcement codes of ethics. People need to understand that that's true, those are facts, and if they ever allow us, for example, in the case of Leonard Peltier, very soon, we hope to prove that. We hope to prove to people that the government, the FBI, and local levels of police agencies do commit crimes, do violate the law, and many times convict people unjustly and illegally.
We had a two-part series on the Greensboro, North Carolina murders of the labor organizers, where it was revealed that the FBI and the local police, et cetera, actually instigated the violence, actually infiltrated these different groups and themselves began the violence. Isn't there a parallel here to the Peltier case and the Wounded Knee case, where it's not that the Indians instigated the violence, but rather the FBI themselves began that? Do you have some information?
Well, yes, we do. And the most glaring example that we have, of course, is Douglas Durham, who infiltrated the American Indian Movement. And we have part of the Amnesty International report regarding the American Indian Movement and the FBI. And I was just reading here whereby documented already is Douglas Durham's case. Douglas Durham got to be in leadership, or got next to the leadership of the American Indian Movement. Today, Douglas Durham, after he was uncovered as an informant of the FBI, is today a very not wealthy, but very comfortable person who travels on the college circuit, and also paid by the John Birch Society to discredit groups that are active action groups, social action, political activist groups, progressive organizations, to discredit their work. And he's now supported and financed by the John Birch Society, and we understand that connection too with all the other agencies. So again, like you say, there's very similar
parallels. And he actually instigated the violence, this Durham.
Of course.
He infiltrated the groups. And
he would find the explosives. He would find the, he would come up with the clever ideas. And the same thing in Leonard.
And they knew who was traveling where, when people were going to do this and that. They just had it down pat.
What's been the reaction of the mass media and all that? You never see anything in the regular press about Leonard Peltier or what's really going on to the Native American people.
We do have some developments working with, such as contracts with 20th Century Fox to do movies on a portrayal in Leonard's life, okay, as well as to give some accounts of the oppression and the movement and what the people were fighting for.
There's a book coming out, too.
We have a major novel that is now into the publisher. It's called Spirit of Crazy Horse, or either Crazy Horse Spirit. And it'll be a story on Leonard's life. And again, it'll be given actual times, dates, places, and experiences, and all the actual names of everybody is involved into the book.
Robert Redford is the one who is primarily interested in doing a movie on this.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of his own investigations right now. Really researching the movie, because right now I think our commitments are getting stronger to where he will probably want to produce and direct the movie for us. Of course, in our contracts, we're open to really anybody who we want to choose that will tell the truth in the best way it can be told on film.
What about network television? The 60 Minutes, for instance, done anything?
Well, but presently, this year's part of the work of building the awareness for Leonard is to get a lot of the American people to write letters to 60 Minutes to have them take an interest in the Peltier story, such as to Paul Lowenwater, who works within the network. Phil Donahue, we have connections into ABC Close-Up. People's Magazine came out a year ago in April with an article on Leonard that was very well. New Age Magazine. So he's been in the Rolling Stones. He's been in the Village Voice, so it is picking up on a lot of levels. But keeping it in the local media right now is the responsibilities that all the support groups that are having in their areas right now. Like, you asked about international support. We have like over 40 support groups throughout the countries in Europe that have active groups going, okay? In the United States, we have approximately 30 groups. And throughout this tour since March 8th, in which we've been on a constant public awareness campaign to support the writ, we've established at least 14 more groups to add to the national level. So, I mean, we're building very rapidly, and the most beautiful thing of all is to see the spirit of the people come together under serious issues such as Leonard, and standing up to see the spirit that's generated to keep us going is very strong. And really, you can only say so much because it's an invisible power that we're all looking for in reality, what unity really means, what sharing, working together really means. And I really think through the experiences, we came a long way, because all people knew about before was that Leonard was put on a 10 most wanted list and he was a killer and people didn't want no part of it, you know. And now that we've been able to build awareness worldwide on him, it's growing to where people are becoming concerned if they're given a chance to hear the case. And that's the realities of it. And we just hope to just keep on in the manner that we're going. Our chances of Leonard winning the new trial is very positive. We don't want to think no other way. And we hope we can build a mass movement worldwide, such as we did with Angela Davis, to stop the Vietnam War, to stop the draft, because we're going to have to redo all these things again with how they got plans for people to do the draft again, you know, and they're going to be taking them. I mean, they're already messing with the old people's blood, Social Security and pension checks that they're getting, and with the high prices of all the energies going up, you know, that we need for our lifestyles. I mean, people need to organize. They need to get together, and right now I think one of the most important elements of life that people need to start learning is not just look at nature as a coincidence and things happen naturally, but we have to start understanding on how we are a part of that survival, and we have to start learning to respect and use those things together in the best way possible instead of putting prices on them and forget about the people if they couldn't follow this understanding of the policy and the education on how you take care of your needs. Then they don't have no way of surviving. Then what do? They steal, they become alcoholics, and they just wind up committing suicide. They send them to institutions. I mean, we have a sick society because people's got problems. And we set up different little programs, and now all those programs that are dealing with people's lives are being threatened through Reagan's madness of the nuclear energy. All the nuclear warheads going into Europe, you know, is really incredible, because right now they have enough to blow up the world. And if we allow the government to blow up the world, I mean, we're gone as people. The generations are no more. I mean, the earth will survive itself in time. You know, it'll be thousands of years before it'll regather its strength in order to have its natural strength again, you know. But what's going to happen to the people if we allow the uranium thing to go on? And I think examples such as are coming out of a lot of different nuclear alliance groups, such as the one in Canada 2 years ago now, through testing of a mother moose, they had to find out why she gave birth to a two-headed moose. She was eating the vegetation life, and they found out from the testing that the uranium chemicals changed their hormones. And if this can happen to an animal with two heads, what can happen to people in reality, when we already know for 20 years in the community of Oglala, in the government housing that they put up, there's uranium chemicals in the wall in which people are affected by the outcome of that today. And it's just a matter of time on how it does away with each and every individual, because the creations of the great mystery is really beautiful if we can just learn to look at it and evaluate it, what it really has to offer. And living with man-made laws that put prices on our natural rights to use the land and the air and the water is incredible. You know, that's taken away from a natural born right, because our Indian people had a way of life in this land, and today we're struggling to hang on to that knowledge in order for these children to have a chance in the coming futures. Because you look at the government going into the space age is unbelievable, where we can think we're going to be space people. You know, we're Earth people, and we need the air, and we need the water, and we need the land, and we're going into unknown things that we should not tamper with, in simple sense. We don't need to tamper with. Ever since they've been to the moon, the seasons have not been the same. It's been a big imbalance. And the earth is losing its energies, because in our Indian beliefs, you just can't keep taking from the earth and taking and taking and taking, using up all those energies. Around the world, energy is being used 24 hours a day from the trucks, from the time they take it from the earth, putting it through the processes, transporting it to the people, getting it into the stores, the people going to work, getting their checks, buying these things that they need. And we look in time, where does it all go back? It goes back into the garbage that we've just polluted and contaminated. And we destroy the earth. Simple process of understanding. But what do we do to change that? I think this is where we're at in understanding. We all got our differences. We've all got our lifestyles, our jobs that we believe in, what we're trying to learn to make a good future. But that's just for our future. That's not for the children, because they're going to be completely different also. You know, and to what, you know, a dream of what it was to live the life of my ancestor is a big hurt in many of our people, that they just don't know how to express. So the only way they can express this is to sacrifice the society and that is destroying us and start learning what is really your roots, your language, the traditions on how you identify foods, when you hunt, when you fish. Today you can't do that because there's nothing to fish and there's nothing to hunt. And you got to have licenses, and then when you get licensed, you still got to pay for your hunt. You know, and there's so many processes. People hunt for game, for just enjoyment. Put trophies of animals that had a spirit, they put them on the wall, locking them into zoos. You look around the world today, flying in a plane, and you look down, you see all the land is cultivated into little squares where they've got fences. Everybody owns this. And see, it just lost the energy. See, when you keep taking from the earth and you build establishments such as this, Italy gives us a good example that the time just takes care of it. It's going to, you know, we can keep rebuilding it all we want. Time is going to take care of it. But is our children going to be able to carry on those knowledges that we live by? But they're not true knowledges. They're destroying us, but yet we've all accepted it. You know, and we talk about Constitution, but the Constitution isn't it. It's natural born rights. From the time we are born, from the time we're in our mother's wombs in that water for 9 months, we come out and breathe the air, we're already exposed to all this confusion out here when before we had a simple way of what the natural law was. See, the medicine world, taking somebody else's eyes, somebody else's heart, is incredible. And we weren't born to do that. We weren't born to be dope addicts and shove needles down our throats and confuse our minds with alcohol just because we can't take care of our weaknesses and we have to entertain ourselves. We had ways and medicines. Everybody had a job. Everybody had a different little job that fitted in. Not everybody was a medicine man or a buffalo hunter, or not everybody can capture the eagle, which was a medicine of wisdom and knowledge. You know, it was people like Sitting Bull, who went 100 years ago, tried to take his people into Canada because of the oppression that they were being forced on the reservation, being massacred and everything else. And they captured and brought him back into it. It's the same thing with Leonard Peltier, but only he couldn't take his people into Canada. They're struggling for the last remaining lands they have left, and it's right there at home. You know, and so this is the reality of it. I mean, we've been put on reservations. We're claiming various parts of the country, such as the Black Mesa for the Arizona, for the Navajo, Hopi people. Over here for the six Iroquois nations, you got the New York State into Canada. And over here for us in South Dakota, it's the Black Hills, you know, just like it is for the people of the Northwest who are maintaining to keep the natural fish from becoming imitation fish from the enhancement through the fisheries program. On how they're claiming the fish by clipping their nose from the time they take the egg, they rear them into little processes. When the fish get about this big, they take each and every one and put a metal clip in their nose. So they go out to their natural environment for 4.5 years, come back to their natural ground, and when the fishermen catch the fish, they have to ticket it in the process. And this is how the government's claiming the fish. And they're only going to give you so much, you can't get the regular price. But see, those values there destroyed the traditional values of our people on the reservations over there, because in the old day, when an Indian person was fish, his first catch would go as a ceremony and an offering to the families or the spirits. And then his catch would come for what he needs to prepare for those winter months that are coming, see. I mean, we've lost all those concepts of sharing, trading, when we all have a natural right to use the air, the water, and all the foods that come with it, see? So I think these are serious things that the uranium madness is creating a threat to, you know, and it's one of the biggest things. And then the war is about the draft. In a natural sense, we weren't born into this world to have to fight wars for people. We were born on this world to live a life of peace somehow. We need to get back to that. That's the reality of it, you know?
And so it's been since days of old when Custer died for a mountain of gold. But times have changed and passed them by. They've been replaced by the FBI. Oh, it's all so easy to weep and moan for a warfare fought so far from home. You can preach of peace from a righteous stand, but there ain't no peace on the Indian land. Joe Stuntz was lower down, the winds did blow with a mighty sound, and the answer came in the driving rain, this man shall not have died in vain. For the hollow power
the lock and key ain't nothing to the power of the raging sea, or the lightning strikes in the angry skies that puts the power into people's eyes. Oh, the weather is building to a mighty storm, and the words in the wind that come to warn are once more spoken to your ear, only this time the name is Leonard Peltier. Many have gone before, and tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian Wars.
At Duck Valley Indian Reservation, a Shoshone Paiute family of a nation in protest burns in flames, dies in flames, while across the sky, the American Indian movement burns the imperialist flag on the lower steps of the white man's house. Looking Eagle loses his wife, the wind, loses Sunshine, Ricardo Starr, and Eli Chasing Sun. But the wind still carries the star into the sky, and the sun is changing into the spirit of Crazy Horse. One does not sell the earth upon which the people walk. The land is still here. They did not steal it. They could not. A young one, not yet born, is lost in murderous flames as colonial agents descend upon the land with violence. It's our primary task. We will defend the land, defend the freedom of the open plains with flesh offerings on an angry body. For the indigenous family, the entire life is aflame. The veins are aflame, the heart is aflame, the eyes are aflame, the fist and the mind are aflame. One eagle feather sparks the sovereign prairie fire, and from D.C. to Duck Valley, to Wounded Knee and Ogallala, the weapons of liberation are aflame.